One thing that I like is that it's very obvious that we're getting further in the week, right? Because you can tell you're getting used to interacting with each other, and I think from my perspective that's a great thing, right? That we're getting these dialogues going and forming these ideas. So that's I like hearing that. So okay, it's good. All right. So my topic today is game theory versus entrepreneurs, or no, it's the other way around, right? Entrepreneurs versus game theory. One thing that I want to make very clear up front is that it's not my purpose to undermine all of game theory and declare that this is something that's completely and utterly misguided and useless. Right? I don't think that's actually true. I think there are possibly insights that we can get from game theory, but the real problem is that the way we typically would see it applied is that it doesn't take account of entrepreneurship and creativity and problem solving that we do actually see in real people. Right? So it's not so much that I want to unearth game theory and make it totally debunked. No, that's not the goal. Right? The goal is just to show that it's often misused, and that if we take the Austrian insights about entrepreneurs and entrepreneurship, we can criticize the standard uses of game theory and come up with entirely different conclusions than we would often see. All right. So let's just start out. First, how many people here have taken a course that included some kind of game theory? Doesn't have a sense. Okay, the grand majority. Okay. How about how many people have seen the movie A Beautiful Mind? It's almost like taking a course in game theory, just not a very good course. Yeah. Yeah. Like, any professor that teaches game theory and doesn't complain about A Beautiful Mind is doing you a disservice, because, in fact, they totally misrepresent a lot of the insights of just standard game theory. They get it wrong in the movie. Well, it's Hollywood. Okay. So I'm going to start out not with a definition, because I find that game theory is something that's very hard to define. Right? In fact, you look for definitions of what is game theory, and it's not ever really clear. Right? Often we'll say something like, oh, game theory is a branch of something or other, without really saying what it is. So I think we're going to learn game theory not so much by definition as by just kind of immersing ourselves in what game theory is supposed to be and getting a sense of what it is. What we use game theory for, though, is to analyze the behavior of groups, specifically where one member of the group has a big impact on other members of the group based on whatever they decide to do. The traditional setup for game theory, many of you have probably seen this before, we call the prisoner's dilemma. Move this over here. Ah, that works. Maybe. That's unidirectional, isn't it? Okay. So we have the prisoner's dilemma. So the story here, we have two prisoners who have been caught committing some crime, and so they decided they were going to go into some criminal enterprise together. Definitely cannot see that. I'll turn off these lights. Ah, that's much better. Okay. So the prisoner's dilemma. We have these two people are working together in some type of crime, or at least something that has been declared to be a crime. But they managed to get caught. Apparently they're not very successful criminals. And the police take them into the police station and take them into two separate rooms, right, and give them this choice. Right? So the first prisoner, I'm going to call, I'm not creative with names, so we're going to call it prisoner A. Right? You have the choice. Right? You can either confess to the crime that we know you committed, or you can choose not to confess. Okay. Meanwhile, next door we have prisoner B. Also has exactly the same choice, to confess or not. And the police inform you that, well, okay, now if neither of you confess, the fact is we don't have really great evidence against you, but we can get you on a lesser charge. So if neither of you confess, we can say put you in prison for 2 years. And so each of you are stuck 2 years in prison. Okay. So I'm going to offer you a deal. Right? If the other person doesn't confess, and you do, right? Well, we're going to let you off. Right? You're cooperating with us, with the authorities, so we'll look past this time. Right? Just don't be bad again. Right? So prisoner A faces this decision. If they confess or not under these circumstances, if they don't confess, they have 2 years in prison. If they do, they get off scot-free, so they have 0 years in prison. Of course, on the other hand, We have now helped the authorities bring prisoner B down. They have a relatively long prison sentence, let's say 10 years.
Okay.
Of course, now, the reverse is also true. Right? If you decide not to confess, but the other one does, then they get off scot-free. Right? So prisoner A, you will end up with 10 years in prison. Well, prisoner B, who has confessed on you, gets off scot-free with 0 years in prison. I will actually turn this where you can read it. There, that's better. All right. And then the final, last possibility is maybe you both confess, in which case we can get you both on this more serious charge, but at the same time you pled guilty, so plea bargaining that goes on. So you're going to go away for 5 years. So that's the idea of the prisoner's dilemma, right? We have this choice that we have to make. And then what's the result going to be? Well, prisoner A would reason in this type of way. They would say, well, suppose that I can really trust prisoner B, so I know they're not going to confess. They will not betray me. We've been friends a long time, something like that. Well, in that case, if I confess, I don't go to prison. If I don't confess, I have 2 years in prison. Well, so it's much better for me as prisoner A to go ahead and confess under those circumstances. But now suppose that I don't really trust prisoner B. He is, after all, a criminal. He's kind of a shady guy. He's probably going to look out for himself. He very well might turn me in. So in that case, I can either confess and have 5 years in prison or not confess and have 10 years. Well, certainly 5 years in prison is better than 10. So even in that situation, I'd want to confess. So it ends up, as prisoner A, it doesn't actually matter what I believe prisoner B is going to do. The best thing for me to do for myself is to confess. So prisoner A wants to confess. Prisoner B in the room next door faces exactly the same set of incentives and therefore would make exactly the same decision. So we end up with a situation where both of our prisoners confess. Okay. So what's the problem? Well, from the game theorist's perspective and the way this is typically applied, is we'd say, well, we ended up with an outcome that is not socially desirable. Despite the fact that each of us is following our own individual self-interest, we ended up with an outcome that's bad. We both confessed, we both got 5 years in prison. If only we had done the opposite, if neither of us had confessed, we would have each gotten 2 years in prison. We're both clearly better off in this kind of situation. Okay. So that's kind of what the prisoner's dilemma tells us, and it gives us that very interesting result. Here's a case where if we follow our self-interest, we create these horrible outcomes. Now, it ends up the prisoner's dilemma has all kinds of applications we tend to see. One would be in the case of, say, collusion with cartels. That's one application. We kind of imagine the same kind of scenario where we have various members that are part of the same industry. Right? They're meeting in some smoky back room trying to form this cartel. Right? What we want to do, we want to restrict production, prop up prices, take advantage of the consumer. Right? Well, now the good news, according to game theorists, is that as soon as they leave this smoky back room, every single individual that was there and made this agreement is going to go back on it. They're going to say, well, now, as a group, it would make sense for us all to restrict production, prop up prices, and take advantage of the consumer. But for me individually, if all these people are working on propping up prices, I can produce a little more, charge a little bit less, and that ends up being good for me. I get all of their business. I have enormous profits from the fact that I betrayed my comrades in this particular enterprise. Okay. And not only I face that decision, so does everybody else. So we end up, this meeting we had in the back room to decide what was going to happen is ultimately meaningless. Right? The whole thing, the whole enterprise ends up falling apart. We also would end up using this particular prisoner's dilemma setup sometimes to describe trade policy. And how is it that we can, nearly all economists, regardless their stripe, whether they're Austrian or not, tend to agree that free trade is on the whole a good thing, right? And that we'd be better off with freer trade, lower tariffs, and what have you. I think it's 90-some percent of economists, according to most surveys, say free trade is a good thing. Yet at the same time, the political system doesn't give us that. It often gives us protectionist policies. Well, why so? We can use the same kind of setup to argue that, well, if the rest of the world has free trade and we protect, then that's good for us in terms of jobs, It's politicians deciding policy, and politicians care about jobs. It's good rhetoric. Right? We can protect our own market against all this foreign competition, and we also get to sell abroad. Right? So it makes sense for us to protect. Right? And in fact, every country faces this exact same incentive, so we end up with a world full of protectionism. Another case where we can apply this, some of them get kind of silly at times. There's one textbook by Frank and Bernanke. They have a very extensive section on game theory. That's one of Frank's specialties. He says, well, we could look at, say, baseball players and their use of steroids. We could stick it in the same framework. Right? Does it make sense for a baseball player to use steroids? Well, if nobody else is using steroids, it gives me an advantage to go ahead and use steroids. Right? But in fact, everybody faces exactly the same incentive, so we all use steroids. The games are roughly as fair as they would be without anybody using steroids. And we just have diminished health because of the fact that we're using this drug that is not particularly good for us. Right? So we have all these kinds of applications. Right? It ends up we can use not a prisoner's dilemma, but a similar setup to describe a number of other things. For example, Keynes's explanation for why depressions last forever, and that is actually virtually literal. Depressions, in Keynes's mind, there's no reason we would necessarily get out of them, except in the very, very long run when all of our capital goods finally totally are demolished and we have to invest. So why is it that this may happen? Well, we have a number of different companies out there all deciding. Right. So here's firm A. We could either have a high level of investment here at firm A, or we could have a low level of investment. And meanwhile, firm B has exactly the same choice. Right. High investment or low investment. And if we live in a world where everybody invests a lot, that's a very good thing. Right? We end up with full employment, that kind of thing. I'll summarize the Keynesian story this way. Right? It's a smiley face. Right? Right? We're all happy in this world where we have high investment. Right? But on the other hand, it's also possible for us all to have very low investment, in which case we have exactly the opposite. Right? We all are very depressed in this depression. Now, he would claim that if we end up in this depression, it's actually something that's very hard to get out of because, individually, if everybody else, say, firm B is investing low, firm A is thinking, should I invest a little amount of money or a lot of money? Well, he would claim that for firm A, you would have significant losses if you go out and start investing a lot while nobody else is. Because since nobody else is investing, there's no income out there, can produce a good that nobody wants to buy or nobody can buy, being the big key. Nobody can afford to buy it because there's no income. So you end up taking enormous losses. So the way that I can do what's best for me, right, if everybody else is investing very little, so do I. Right. Now, on the other hand, if everybody else is investing a lot, right, then it ends up I have lower profits by investing a little than if I invest a lot. Right, so in that case, right, if everybody else is investing a lot, I want to go ahead and invest a lot. Right. So this would be a case where we'd say we have multiple equilibria. So I drew the rest of the face around the smile and frown. Okay. Right. Where either of these is a possibility. Right. Like maybe, right, if we all happen to be in a good mood, right, we'll all invest a lot, and this is something that would tend to be sustainable, except for when one of us kind of gets depressed. And then things start falling apart. This is why Keynes really does have to rely on things like animal spirits to explain how we end up in the depression to start with. Right? How we stay there, relatively easy. Right? But how we get there is hard. Right? We have to have some kind of wave of pessimism. He describes very vividly in his book that investors are like schools of fish. Right? If you're like me, I like to visit aquariums. Right? And you watch the fish, right? And they all are in a group, and they all tend to go the same direction. Right? Then something happens, or maybe nothing happens. They get skittish, and they all turn the other direction. So it's very much what Keynes has in mind. Is okay, we're all going one direction. Things are going very well. Then we investors get skittish, and we go the other direction. The economy crashes. So this would be a case, because there are multiple equilibria, in Keynes's mind, there's no way out. Now, we know there are a number of ways we could criticize this. The biggest, in my mind, being that Keynes had no understanding of the fact that prices actually coordinate economic activity. Right. So lots of ways we can criticize this, but we can understand what he was saying in these types of terms. Another place that we could apply game theory would be in the case of, say, public goods. In the so-called free rider problem. One of the great market failures, or great alleged market failures, is that there are some types of goods out there that it's basically impossible to force people to pay for, right, without some kind of government stepping in and taxing them. Right? So you can't force people to pay for it because they're going to get the benefit regardless. National defense is one of the very common things that is considered to be a public good by the standard. Though often roads are, which is kind of puzzling. I often pay tolls to go down roads, so it's not clear that we can't force people to pay for roads. Anyway, but let's say it's something like national defense. Okay. Or another case would be a lighthouse. Right, that light is going to exist. Everybody benefits from it. That's out on the ocean. You can see the light. Right? It makes it very hard to force you to pay to be part of it. So let's do something of a silly example. Let's say of my wife and I. Right, so here's me. Here's my wife. Right. And because we like to run a very individualist household, right, each of us has our own budget that we run by. It's not actually true, but let's just assume that. Each of us has our own money. And we're trying to decide, should we buy this nice vase of flowers to put on our living room table? Now, this has the nature of a public good, right, in that both of us get the benefit of seeing and smelling these flowers, right, and one of us cannot force the other not to have that benefit unless we get kicked out of the house, something like that. Let's say we're not even considering that. All right, so then the question is, are we going to pay for these flowers or not? Right. So I could offer to pay, or I could not, as could my wife. And let's suppose that this vase of flowers costs something like $20. So if we each chip in $10, we can buy the thing. Now, to me, I would be willing to pay, say, up to $15 to get this vase and put it there on the table. Right. So it's worth $15 to me. I'd happily spend that to get the vase. So we can see the case. If we both decide to pay, it costs us $10 each. So our outcome would be we get the vase, right? But we each lose $10 in the process. Now here, I'll just write down my payoffs to make the argument, keep it somewhat smaller. Okay. But on the other hand, if my wife commits that she is going to pay and make sure we get the vase, and I decide not to, right, then I, from my perspective, I get the benefit of the vase being there and it doesn't cost me anything. Meanwhile, if my wife doesn't pay, well, I could pay for it myself, right? In which case, we would have the vase, but it would cost me $20, right? And I don't consider that to be worthwhile. I'm only willing to pay up to $15 to get the thing. Or I could not pay for it, since my wife's also not paying for it. In that case, we have, nothing actually happens there. And we follow the same kind of argument as in the prisoner's dilemma. Right? Okay, suppose that my wife has committed to pay. In that case, I'm better off not paying. I would just want a free ride. Riding for free on what my wife is paying for. So in that case, I don't want to pay. But suppose that my wife has committed, no, she's definitely not going to pay. Do I want to pay? Well, the answer is still no. We would have the vase if I did, but I'm not willing to pay $20 for it. So we end up with a situation where neither of us pay for the vase, despite the fact that we would both be better off if we both could manage to pay for the vase. Okay. Can use the same kind of logic. I'm not going to go into the details of it. We can use very similar logic with things like the tragedy of the commons as well. Right? Okay, should we use this particular public piece of land? Well, I do get a benefit for myself if I do. But if all of us try to get that benefit, we end up running it into the ground and it ends up virtually worthless. Right? Okay. Right, so we can use these types of arguments to understand where people are coming from when they're talking about public goods. Or when Keynes talks about depressions, or when we talk about collusion and cartels and these kinds of things. Okay. So it's kind of just a crash course in some of how game theory is often used within the mainstream and typical cases. But let's think about what the story actually is. Right? We're talking about two criminals getting together, deciding they're going to commit a crime, going back to the traditional prisoner's dilemma. And there's some potential they might get caught. Okay? And if they get caught, it's reasonable for them to believe, right, that they're going to end up with this kind of deal offered to them. Right? The police are very happy to work with you if you'll work with them. You're going to get a shorter prison sentence if you confess than if you don't. Right? Right? So it's possible for us to foresee this coming. Right? Now here I'm really relying on one of the conceptions of an entrepreneur that the Austrian school brings. Right? Right? Mises tells us that what makes entrepreneurs is that they have good foresight. They can foresee problems before they happen. Right? Or often in a business situation, we'd say you have good foresight in terms of what you can sell your good for and what your costs will be. Right? But this foresight idea is something that's far more broad. Right? We can foresee a situation where there will be a problem, and that allows us then to start planning. Here I'd also draw on another conception coming out of the Austrian school of the entrepreneur. Kirzner's conception of the entrepreneur is that what makes an entrepreneur is that they're very alert to opportunities that others would miss. Just an example of that, I don't know if this is original to him or whether it's just something that came to me when I was reading him, is suppose that, say, you're here on campus, right, it's about time for class. Right, we know typically what happens is people will be outside, say you actually have nice weather. Unlike us in Northeast Ohio, we do not. Right, but you have nice weather, people congregate outside. When it comes very close to class time, we all head toward the doors to go in. Right? And if you're like me, you like to observe human behavior and all of its insanity. Right? And you notice, right, people open, say, in the U.S., we would tend to open the right door to go in. The double doors here, we open the right door, and all the students try to squeeze through this one door. Right? Despite the fact that there is that left door nobody's coming out of, right, we could open it and go in there. So from Kirzner's perspective, the entrepreneurial student will be the one that looks and says, well, this is idiotic. Right, let's open that second door and walk through. Right, so alertness to that opportunity to make things better is what makes the entrepreneur. Here I'm going to combine the two and say that we have foresight. We know as these potential prisoners, as these criminals, that this kind of situation may be coming down the line. At the same time, we're also alert to different things we might possibly do. We're creative. We're problem solvers. We have, some insight into the fact that we can actually change the world around us. Right? So what might we do? Well, it ends up one of the central assumptions anytime you see a game theorist draw one of these game matrices, is what we call it. Right? We write down all these payoffs. Right? We immediately assume that the structure of the game is fixed. Right? As soon as it's written down on that paper, this is in marker, it is not in pencil, this cannot be changed. But in reality, is that true? Right? Well, no, not at all. In this case, we are, after all, criminals. Right? Right? We don't necessarily have the best morals. So we could say, well, I know that when we go in that room, we have every reason to confess on each other. So let's do something different. Let's say that if you confess, we're going to have our friend here who's a hitman. Right? We're criminals, we know each other. Right? We're going to have this friend here who's a hitman. He's going to go out and murder your family. Right? If you confess. Right? And I'm willing myself to take exactly the same risk if I confess. Right? So what have we done? Right? We've taken this game matrix and we've changed the payoffs. Right? So now, if prisoner A confesses, while prisoner B confesses, well, now it is true, I only have 5 years in prison rather than 10, but at the same time, I also have a dead family. Here I am assuming that both prisoners like their families and that they know this about each other too. Okay. All right, so this is a very bad thing, right? Personally, I like my family. I would be willing to go to prison for an extra 5 years to save their lives, right? We'd actually have the same situation over here. True, if the other person doesn't confess, and I do, I don't go to prison at all, but I come home to find my family murdered. And that's a rather horrible thing. So now, does it make sense for prisoner A to confess? As long as they care about their family and care about them enough, the answer is no. So instead of confessing, we end up not confessing. Prisoner B, similarly, if they care about their family, is going to end up not confessing. So instead of having the horrible outcome that we had before of us both going to prison for 5 years, we end up both going to prison for two. This is that socially desirable outcome. Well, maybe not desirable, but it's the best we can do, right? Okay. It's that socially desirable outcome that is supposed to be unattainable in the prisoner's dilemma. But we allow our prisoners a little bit of foresight, a little bit of alertness to possible opportunities, a little bit of creativity, and they come up with a solution. It ends up there are other ways to solve this that don't rely quite so much on hitmen and violence. One thing we could do, and this is something that comes right out of the mainstream, right? The way that they say you can solve the prisoner's dilemma is just to repeat it. So we decide, as we form this criminal enterprise, that we're going to be working together on a regular basis, which means that in all likelihood, when we're brought in to confess or not, right, odds are this is going to happen time and time again. That then creates the possibility, right, for me to punish you if you betray me one time. Right? So we go in the first time. If you confess on me, well, the next time around, you can bet I'm going to confess on you. I'll get back at you. Right? And this gives us then an incentive, right, for both of us not to confess and to work together time and time again. So we don't even have to rely on hitmen and dead families necessarily if we can find a way to repeat the game. I would note, this is actually, if you read some, say, international trade or trade policy type of books, you'll often see the role of the World Trade Organization described this way in terms of trade policy. That what the World Trade Organization does is set up kind of a repeating version of this prisoner's dilemma, right? Where every few years we get together and we organize what our trade policy is going to be, how protectionist it's going to be. Right? And we also have built into the World Trade Organization, we're supposed to have this punishment reward kind of system. Right? So if you have very protectionist policies, the rest of the world is allowed to punish you with protectionist policies as well. At the same time, if you have free trade policies, the rest of the world is obligated to have free trade policies toward you. Now, I think there's lots of room for debate as to whether this is actually what the World Trade Organization does, right? But we can understand that it was formed to try to solve this kind of problem. Right? What was it? It was a creative solution to a potential problem of trade policy. Another possible way we could solve, say, collusion and cartels. I'm not sure about this, but I think that the solution was actually offered by Rothbard, where more or less he says, why is this a problem? Right? There's an obvious way around this. Right? If our goal is to get together and act like we're really one big firm dominating the industry, why don't we just get together, merge, and form one big firm dominating the industry? Right? That firm is not going to betray itself. Right? Right? So instead of colluding, we'll just merge. Right? There we go. Problem solved. Right? In fact, that solution... I don't need to appeal to another sheet of paper. It's offered right in this book. It's Huerta de Soto's Money, Bank, Credit, and Economic Cycles. I just picked it up yesterday. I was flipping through. I've made my way most of the way through it. I'm a relatively slow reader, and it's a big book. Right, so that's my excuse. It's true. And I came across this table that you probably can't see, but it ends up technology allows me to do this. That's the wrong way, but... Right. We have this table on page 667 of the book. We're looking at different banks, considering whether or not they're going to expand credit. We start looking at it. What is he really doing? Right. If neither of us expand, we both survive, but with relatively low profits. Right. But if, say, Bank A decides not to expand, well, Bank B does... then B will find out that they are rapidly shown as being insolvent. They can't actually fulfill all of their obligations. They'll fail. Well, Bank A survives. This then, in that kind of situation, would give Bank B a reason not to expand. Meanwhile, if Bank A expands, it makes sense for Bank B to go ahead and expand as well. Right? If they do not expand, they survive. But if they expand, they have large profits. So then the real problem is, how do we organize as banks if we want to have large profits to make sure we get those large profits rather than end up with this bad situation where neither of us are expanding? Right? And so it's really kind of this game theoretic argument. And the claim, right, which I think is a very good one, is we have to set up some kind of authority to arrange this expansion to make sure that it actually happens. And that's, in effect, what the central bank is there to do. Right? To ensure all of us that we can go ahead and expand without having to worry about the whole thing coming collapsing down on us. Right, so this is a case where we can use game theory. I don't think anybody would accuse Huerta de Soto of not being an Austrian. Right? We can use it in an Austrian context to explain how these groups get together and have incentives, right, to come up with creative solutions, maybe undesirable solutions from the social perspective, but to come up with solutions to the problem they have. Okay, let's deal with some other problems. Okay, how about this public goods problem? How do we solve this one? Well, it ends up there's this idea. We call matching funds. When I was living in Columbus, I was going to the Ohio State University. Very picky about the "the" there. So I was going to the Ohio State University. There was one of the radio stations I listened to on the way to work was largely funded by donations. Right, so they would have donation drives, right? Something like 1 week out of every 6 months, something like that. Right? And almost all the time, when they were, you know, pestering you, trying to give you donations, they would say, "Oh, we had this caller call in, and they said for the next 15 minutes they're going to match whatever donations we get." Right? Oh, okay. So why would they do that? Well, apparently they have some belief, right? This donor does, that maybe we can get more donations this way. Because then as an individual donor, I feel like I'm actually getting $2 of donation for every dollar that I personally have to give. So we can do the same kind of idea here with the funding of this particular public good. All right, so here's my wife. Here's me. What's that? Ah. Oh, ha-ha, yeah, thanks. Yeah. My memory is not very good. Yeah, 50 years from now, I'm in serious trouble. Okay. Yeah. Say, if I'm an absent-minded professor now, who knows? Okay. So, we still have these options. Are we going to pay or not? Right, my wife can pay or not. I can pay or not. Well, we set this up in this type of way. Let's say that we make this conditional fund. Right. Right. So, this fund is such that if each of us pledge, right, to put money into it, then we will go out and buy the vase. Right? But if either one of us decides not to put money into it, the vase will not be bought. Right? Okay, so in that case, right, here these would be the cases where it's not being, I'm not giving anything because I'm greedy or what have you. Right? In which case, nothing happens. Right? Me holding out is enough to prevent the vase from happening. Right? Similarly, if my wife holds out in this case, right, the vase doesn't happen. Right? So the only way we get the vase is if we both pay and each pay our fair share of $10. Right. So in this case, what's my incentive? Right. If my wife doesn't give, it actually doesn't matter what I do, so that's not going to have any impact on my decision to make a pledge or not. Right. It doesn't affect me. Right. But here, if there's even the possibility that my wife is going to make the pledge, here I'm kind of weirdly assuming we don't communicate about this at all. But, okay. Right. If there's, you know, any possibility at all she might make the pledge, it makes perfect sense for me too as well. There's no risk at all involved for me making this pledge. If she doesn't, I get my money back, and that's the end of the story. Right? All right, so in this case, we have a reason, right, to pay, as does my wife. We end up with a vase, right, and we're perfectly happy with the outcome. It's the outcome that is desired. We actually provide for this public good. Right? Now, I would note that this is something where it's kind of dangerous as an economist to say what entrepreneurs are going to do. If you came to my previous lecture, you know I'm a terrible entrepreneur. Right. But even I can manage to speculate about some of these solutions, which suggests there are probably entrepreneurs out there that can do better than me. It ends up this particular type of solution is already possible. Right, there's one website you may have heard of if you've been attached with the Mises Institute for any long period of time called The Point. What The Point does, it allows for people to either give money or to attach their name to some cause. And then there is some point at which they've raised enough money or at which some type of criterion has been hit, right? And that sparks, say, the buying of this vase. Or in the case, there's one I'm very connected with the Institute, not officially, but Robert Murphy has agreed that he wants to debate Paul Krugman, and it's Paul Krugman for some reason that's holding out. Right? So what are we going to do to convince Paul Krugman that it's a good idea to come and to debate Robert Murphy? Well, we're going to set up this fund. I just checked it last night. This fund is up to, I believe, $72,000, a little bit above that, right? Where this money will be donated to a food bank in the area around New York City. if the debate happens, right? So what does that mean? Right? It means all of us that would like to see this debate happen, right, can offer to put money into this fund, right, to create this huge guilt trip for Paul Krugman because he's still holding out, right? He's still holding out $72,000, right? You know, it makes you start to question how much does he really believe that we need to do things about hunger. Right. Okay, anyway, so we can all guilt trip him very, very well, and we don't actually have to spend any of our money at all, right, until what we want to have happen happens. Right. We could easily use the point to fund very large public goods the same kind of way. Right. Another, perhaps one more well-known website would be Kickstarter. Right, the idea here being, I think they call it crowdfunding or something like that, where you have an idea you want to get off the ground, you need a certain amount of money to do it. Right, so you have people that are willing to donate, give money, although calling it a donation is probably a stretch because you offer them things in exchange. Say, so, okay, if we hit these targets, then say I want to write a novel, well, I'll give you a free copy of my novel if you pay $25 toward letting me start writing it, something like that. Right, Kickstarter can do exactly the same kind of thing. Right, so offering these types of solutions to these game theoretic constructs is not... It's not just, you know, me thinking up crazy ideas of how we can do it. Right? I leave that to Walter Block. Right? No, these things actually exist. Right? We have the solutions there before us. It's just a matter of using them in the ways that we would actually need to, given these particular situations. One great case that I think is quite entertaining. I often try to, well, I don't try to, I end up confessing something during every lecture. British game shows are really entertaining, right? They are. Right? I have to confess, I'm a longtime fan of Big Brother, though I'm trying to break that habit. But it ends up the British version of Big Brother is much better than the American, right? So you have to go to YouTube and watch it. I actually got my wife to watch that, and she hates reality television, but British accents are just impressive to Americans or something. All right. So one of the game shows they have is called Golden Balls. I don't exactly know how the whole game plays, but over the course of this game, you have two players, and they make choices, and eventually end up with this pool of funds, right? They could potentially win. Okay. And the last game that they have to play is a version, it's not quite the Prisoner's Dilemma, because the incentives aren't quite as strong, but it's very close to it. It's a game they call Split or Steal. And we have our two players. I'll actually give them names. Let's say Bob and Jim. Not particularly British names, but okay. And each of them has the choice to either choose split. They have a golden ball, and inside it says split, and they can look and they know what it is, or they can play steal. And the game is played such that if they both play split, they take whatever that pool of money is, right, and they split it 50-50. So let's say over the course of the game, they got the equivalent of, say, $100,000, right? which is actually reasonably close to where the pool ends up being once you account for exchange rates. Right? So if they split it, they each get $50,000. So $50,000 each. Okay. We'll just look at Bob's perspective here, understanding that Jim is only different in name. Okay. So if Jim plays split and Bob plays split, we each get $50,000. That's pretty good. But on the other hand, if Bob has a guess that Jim is going to play split, Bob can steal, at which point he gets all $100,000. Right? Right. What's that? Yes, not each. Thank you. Yeah. Right. So he gets all $100,000. Jim walks away with nothing. Yeah, that's why it's not each. Right. If Bob's the one playing split while Jim plays steal, then he's the one that got the raw end of the deal. Right? And he ends up with nothing. If they both play steal, well, then they walk away with nothing because, after all, we don't want to reward greedy people, right? Unless only one of them's greedy, I guess. Right. All right. So we can analyze this from a game theoretic standpoint. Say, okay, what's going to happen? Well, Bob says, if Jim plays steal, there's nothing I can do. I'm not going to think about that. So if Jim plays split, what's best for me to do? Oh, I'm going to play steal. That's the better option. Right. Jim faces exactly the same set of incentives, right, and he would also play steal. The end result being that we both walk away empty-handed, and the game show is very, very happy with us because this is a very, very cheap game to produce. Right? It's wonderful. It's no wonder the network designed it this way, right? Okay. All right. So this is the game, right? And they try to make it very interesting by actually giving our prisoners, right, an opportunity to talk to each other beforehand. Okay, you have talking to do, I believe, is what the host tends to say. You have some talking to do. And inevitably, we have the two people talking, and they'll either say, oh, you know that I'm going to play Split. I'm a nice person, right? I'm obviously going to play Split. Clearly, I'm going to play Split. Or often it's a good sign that the person's going to play Steel if instead of declaring their own intention to play Split, they start making sure that you're going to. Right, okay. You're going to play Split, right? You're definitely going to play Split, aren't you? And you can find videos of people doing this. Okay, but it ends up one of the most interesting times that we had this game played. We had a very entrepreneurial Jim playing the game. So they're given this opportunity to talk. And what Jim says, more or less, if you want to understand it in these terms, is he says, forget the game that the network's giving us. I'm offering you a different deal. I'm going to play Steel. So he declares ahead of time, I'm going to play Steel. You almost never see people do this, right? Because we understand kind of morally that's equivalent to saying I'm a greedy jerk. Right? Nobody wants to say this, even if it's true. Right? But he says, no, I'm going to play Steel. Oh, went on to another sheet. Oh. Awareness of my surroundings is not my strength. Okay. All right. So we have Split. We have Steel. Yeah, I split it. That's good. That's good. Okay, so you have Bob here, is the poor guy that's having to listen to this nutter, Jim, declare, I'm definitely going to play Steel, and here's the deal. Right? If you play Split, I'll give you half the money. What? Right. Well, what did Jim do? Right. He changed the game. Right. He said, no, forget this whole zeros if I play Steel. I'm going to play Steel, I guarantee you that. And here's what's going to happen. If you play Steel, I don't have any money to give you. Right? If you play Split, I have $100,000, the equivalent thereof. Right? I'll give you half of it. So you get $50,000. Right? If you play Split. Right? All right. So then, what's the situation that Bob finds himself in? Right? Hmm. Right. If he believes Jim, the right thing to do is to play Split. Right? It actually makes sense, I don't mean right thing in this moral sense, but in terms of his own self-interest, it makes sense for him to go ahead and play Split in that case. Jim just created an incentive for Bob to do what is going to, in the end, potentially be the right thing for both of them. Right? Right. And Bob here is naturally very unhappy. These aren't their real names. I don't recall what they were. Bob says, oh, you're loony, this is nuts, you're going to lose everything because you're a crazy person. Right. And, oh, Jim was just incredible to watch because he's very, very serious. I'm going to play Steel. I guarantee you I'm going to play Steel. So it's up to you. Right? Are you going to play Split and get half the money? Or are you going to play Steel too? And we both walk away with nothing. Okay. Well, so what ends up happening? Right. Well, you can see, watching Bob's face, he's so torn. Right. Right. Because he's convinced he's sitting across from a crazy person. Right? Right. But it ends up when crazy people say they're going to do crazy things, you can generally trust them. Right? So Bob says, okay, fine. He doesn't say it. Right? He makes his choice and there's all kinds of drama. Right? He opens his golden ball to reveal what has happened. And Bob has, in fact, played Split. As has Jim. Right? Because you think about it, right, Jim, if he is actually an honest person, right, he's changed his own incentives too. Right, and that now he no longer has any necessary reason to play Steel. Right, if he is actually willing to give half the money away anyway, he might as well save himself the trouble of writing the check and just play Split to start with. Right, and that's the result we got, both playing Split. Right. So what do we see? Right, we see real people put into a situation that game theorists will draw out, as we did here, Right? I'll say, oh, here's the outcome that is most likely. Everybody's going to walk away empty-handed. There's definitely no way, if you analyze this kind of situation, there's no way, no way at all, we're both going to end up playing split. But an entrepreneurial gym can change the game, right? And that's what our entrepreneurs do, right? An entrepreneur that has good foresight, that is actually alert to possibilities out there, changes the game that people end up playing.
Okay.
All right. So, another example that I definitely do have time to go into. You know, confession time again. Occasionally I make mistakes. This happened to me once. No, I already told about that, my $1.19 sitting in my stockbroker's account. It didn't start there. So I made a mistake then. I also made a mistake another time, and actually several times in my life, of getting involved with discussions online. Right? There has to be some kind of psychological explanation for why this is so addictive. XKCD, if you're familiar at all with that website, has this great, it's a comic, it's a web comic. Right? And they have this great comic strip where there's somebody saying, oh, it's time to go to bed, aren't you going to come to bed? This person is furiously typing on the computer. Right. Says, no, this is important. People are wrong on the internet. Right. Right. I've lost a lot of sleep because people were wrong on the internet. So one time that I was losing sleep over people being wrong on the internet was this discussion, and I believe it was actually on one of the old Mises blogs. Somebody blogged something related to healthcare, I think. And this discussion arose as to whether it's possible in a free market without government intervention for the poor to get vaccinated against things like polio, that type of stuff, these horrible diseases. The argument that those of us that believe in freedom were making was, yes, this is possible. Right? But there's one person, I don't have any idea what their handle was, certainly wouldn't know what their real name was, right? Saying, no, it's not possible, not possible, and eventually started hinting that there was some kind of game theoretic argument. Oh, right. And here I think, oh, I like game theory. One of my vices is studying game theory. I have lots of vices, but that's one of them. And so I started trying to stick what they were saying into some kind of game theoretic terms to find out, okay, what are they actually trying to say? And here's what I came up with. This game's a little bit different than the others, in that the others we tend to have the two players have the same set of choices available to them. Here we have the players have a different set of choices available. Right? So we have, on the one hand, the wealthy that could afford to pay for vaccines. Right? On the other hand, we have the poor that can't afford to pay for the vaccines themselves. Right? Okay. So we have, okay, the wealthy here. They can either, their choice is either to pay for the vaccines that then the poor will have the benefit of. Right? So they do this as a means of charity. Right? Or they could not. Meanwhile, the poor have the option to either take the vaccines themselves or not. Right. Kind of what this person was arguing, I eventually finally figured out, was right, if we think about this in the standard game theoretic kind of way, the rich are going to act like they don't have any control over what the poor does. Right? I, as Jim, I have no control over Bob, well, until I get creative. Right? That's going to end up being the solution here, too. Right, so the rich, they feel like they have no control over the poor. They will eventually get creative, though. Right, so they're thinking, right, suppose that the poor are going to take the vaccine. As a wealthy person, if I know they're going to take the vaccine either way, it doesn't make sense for me to pay for it. Well, here, now the answer is actually no. Right? Right, because if I know they're going to take it anyway, I want to save my money. Right? I'm going to go ahead and grant that the rich are greedy or what have you. Right? So yeah, they're going to save their money. They're not going to choose up here. They'll choose not to. Now, if the poor are not going to the vaccine, I'm certainly not going to offer to pay for it. That's just a total waste of money. Right? So the rich would not pay for it in that case either. Right? Okay. Then the poor, right, say, well, if the rich were willing to pay, I would happily take the vaccine. Right? We'll accept it because, at least from my perspective, it's basically free. Right? If the rich are not going to pay for the vaccine, I can't afford it. I do have to eat. I have to have some place to live, what have you. And so it ends up all these forces, right, are pushing us toward this outcome, right, which is the bad outcome. Right. The rich refuse to set up any type of fund to fund these vaccines for the poor. And that's ultimately what this person was claiming. Right. But is this really the game that gets played? Right. Is it really true that when the rich approach this question, they think they have no control or no influence over what the poor does? Well, the answer is obviously not that, right? Right? They could, right? If they pay for it, right, they could announce this and say, we're going to pay for the vaccine, right? And the poor end up taking it, right? So we'd end up here. And the rich could, if they wanted, they could say, no, we're not going to pay for the vaccine, and then the poor would end up not taking it. So the rich can actually have a big influence on what the poor end up doing. Do they end up vaccinated or not? Right. Now, knowing this, the rich are not going to say, well, let's act like we don't have any control over them. Right. No. Right. They're going to say, we're going to act first. We're either going to set up these charity clinics offering free vaccines to those that cannot afford them, or are not going to. Right. So what the rich are actually going to compare, right, is this outcome, where they pay for the vaccine and the poor get vaccinated, because that's what would happen if they announced that they're going to pay, right, and did this in some credible way, like actually setting up charity clinics. We're going to compare that to this outcome, because we know if we don't pay for it, the poor can't afford it themselves. Right. So then the rich have to face the question, does it make sense for me to pay and end up with these people getting vaccinated, or does it make sense for me not to pay and have them not get vaccinated? Well, here we could make a number of arguments, one based on something like altruism. Right? Okay, I do actually care about my fellow man. We don't even have to, though. Right? It is actually beneficial to me if polio does not exist anymore, right? if we eradicate these illnesses. That is beneficial to me as a wealthy person, right? And to my family in the future. It's beneficial to me. Right? So it very well might make sense, right, as long as the rich would rather live in a world where the vaccine is paid for and they go ahead and pay for it. They can easily afford a lot of these vaccines. Right? If they'd rather live in this world than that world, we end up in this world. Right? Okay. And we would note, right, if we actually believe in subjective preferences, right, this is only a problem, right, if the rich would rather be here than here. The game theory problem is only really a problem if we end up in a situation that's bad from everyone's perspective. Right? If the rich would rather be here, we do end up here. As long as they have some creativity and can say, yes, we will pay. All right. So there are all kinds of applications where I think we can actually use game theory as long as we keep in mind that the people that we're dealing with are not just lines and rows and columns in a matrix, right, that are being chosen very mechanically. As long as we keep in mind that people are actually creative and take this into account, right, take account of the fact that entrepreneurship is to a certain degree game-changing, then we can actually use it to describe the way that perhaps a free society might work and to solve some of these problems that might be objections that others would have. All right, now I do have just a few minutes for maybe a couple questions. So. Thanks. So any questions? We can chat afterward too, that's fine. All right. Well, thank you very much. Oh, wait, we have a question here. Yeah. Describe the idea of a shilling point just so we all hear it. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. So basically what it boils down to, right, this idea of a shilling point is, you know, that we have information about the other player that we can then use. Right? I think that certainly would, you know, mesh with this idea of, you know, it meshes very well with the idea of foresight and alertness. Right? I'm kind of aware of the way this other person acts, and I take that into account. That would open up a number of opportunities as well in terms of how should I change the game so we can end up with a better outcome. Right? Certainly. I think that would relate very well. That's one thing where a lot of my criticism I don't think is purely, you know, only coming from the Austrian position. Right? Like within game theorists themselves, right, we often see these kinds of solutions. A repeated game was an idea that came about from game theory. This type of explanation of the rich versus the poor and whether we get them paying for vaccines or not is just an application of a different type of game we call a sequential game, where one player gets to declare what they're doing first and make some kind of credible commitment to that. Right? And that's something that comes out of standard game theory, too. That's where I really think when it comes to game theory, we need to be very careful with how we apply it, right? Because it's very, very easy, if we're not careful in watching what people do, to let people pull off what in the end is nonsense once we account for entrepreneurship. And I think that's really the key. We make sure whenever we approach this, that we actually take account of creativity. So I wouldn't criticize game theory on the grounds of it itself being terrible. It's a potentially useful thing as long as we account for the fact that we are dealing with creative people. That was definitely a million-dollar answer to a $2 question. Oh, no, I'm not saying the question was worthless. It was a good question, but I give answers that are way, way beyond what is asked. Oh, now we have time for one more question of that same type. Sure. I'll go ahead and answer that one. One thing. I don't know. Did you look me up on ratemyprofessors.com? Because you might be taking advantage of me here. Because one of the comments on there that my students have made is that I will answer any question until I'm blue in the face. And I think I might be past that point now. But I'll answer that question too. There we go. Practice, right? Anytime somebody asks a question, you try to answer it, right? And I think it really actually started for me probably in high school, and that I got involved with the debate team very early on. And there, part of the way that you win when you're on a debate team is you learn to ask good questions that are going to show the weakness of the other position, and you learn to answer questions in a way that's somewhat convincing. So I think practice coming from that. Right. Other questions? No, all right. Well, we're happy to talk to you in the hall, and thank you very much.